Well, here's a few things to help you get plugged in before this interview. A different kind of campaign, a different kind of party, a different kind of commander-in-chief. Teaching, storytelling, art, music, and liturgy to provoke the political imagination. Turn off the TV, pick up the Bible, and join the revolution of political misfits and cultural refugees. Politics for ordinary radicals. Folks, this is Shane Claiborne, author, passive activist, and new monastic. And he joins us on the show to explain all this stuff, hopefully. Boy, I'm thoroughly confused, man. Like, let's just start with new monastic. Can we just start with that, please?
Yeah. Well, it's not I have to say it's not the only language that I use to describe what we're up to. A lot of other folks have put that language to it. In fact, if I said to my neighbors we're new monastics, I think they'd go, I know you're kind of nasty, but, you know, what are you really talking about here? But part of what folks have seen is that there's a movement within the church right now of folks that are rethinking what it means to be Christian, and that isn't anything new, but it's something that's happened over and over and over, you know, and it seems like every few hundred years we have an identity crisis in the church, and folks go to the deserts and to the margins and rethink their faith. So I guess that's kind of what we're up to.
Oh, we are so there right now. I was talking to Chuck Colson about that sort of thing, and, you know, there's the Evangelical Manifesto. Have you kind of read about that one?
Yeah, sure have.
And there seems to be, even the loss of identity amongst conservative and liberals, you know, Democrats and Republicans, donkeys and elephants, right? I mean, there's just a confusion with the whole identity thing going on with everybody these days, it seems like.
Yeah, Drew, and that's what we've been talking about. In the middle of all the election buzz, we're saying, enough donkeys and elephants, long live the lamb. You know, like, let's really rethink where our central hope and allegiance lies. And I once heard it said that our politics are shaped by what we see out the window. And I grew up in East Tennessee, and that just totally shaped my whole social and political view, and I ended up realizing that I had all these ideologies about the big political issues like abortion and homosexuality, all those things Jesus talked so much about, you know?
Yeah. We really are a two-trick pony.
That's right. And then I started to see, man, I have a lot of things that I think, but very little that I have to show with my life. And this whole campaign is really about embodiment and right living, not just right thinking. Because if there's anything I've learned from both liberals and conservatives, it's that you can have all the right ideas and still be mean.
Yeah.
And if you're mean, nobody really wants to listen to you. So maybe the new political camps for young evangelicals is not left and right, but mean and nice. And I want to be with nice folks.
Isn't that, that's so kumbaya of you. It really is. Hey, how did you go from the Bush Quail campaign in 92 to a dreadlock touting monastic hippie in 2008?
Oh, it's been a long road. When I was in East Tennessee, my dad fought in Vietnam. I watched TV too much, I think, you know, and that shaped who I was. But then I thought, yeah, I've got all the right ideas about homosexuality. And then I came up to Philadelphia, and I met people that just shattered my ideologies. I met this kid who told me that he was attracted to men, and he felt like God made a mistake when God made him. That's what he had been told from the church. And he said he wanted to kill himself. And I thought, dear Lord, if this kid can't find a home in the church, then who have we become? You know, and these issues that I've had a lot to say about are run much deeper than just my ideas. And that's what I love about Mother Teresa. She's one of my heroes, and she pioneered what it means to be pro-life, not because she went around wearing an abortion is murder shirt, but because she said to moms in tough situations, if you're not able to have your baby, you can give it to me. And that has an integrity that you just can't argue with. You know, that's why everybody called her mother. And that's what we want to be. We want to be people that embody our politics and don't just rally politicians to try to change the world for us.
You spent some time with Mother Teresa.
I did.
That's a kind of a rare thing. I mean, I would imagine there'd be quite an application list for people to want to hang with Mother Teresa. How'd you squeak in?
Well, I'm going to be honest. We wrote a letter and said, we'd love to come out there and work with you. You know, we don't know if you give internships out there in Calcutta, you know. And we did not hear back from her. So eventually...
You just showed up.
I just started calling some nuns on the phone. I'm like, I'm trying to get the digits for Mother Teresa. You know, can you help me out here? And finally, they ended up giving me a number. And I call over to Calcutta, Drew, and I'm expecting, you know, a polite Missionaries of Charity, how can we help you? But I just hear this raspy old voice answer the phone. Hello! And I'm like, listen, I'm trying to get a hold of the Missionaries of Charity or Mother Teresa. And then she says, well, this is the Missionaries of Charity. This is Mother Teresa. And and I'm like, and I'm the Pope, you know, what are you talking about?
Yeah, right, lady.
Give me a break. And so she just says, come on out here, come on out and work. And we did. And then I asked her, I say, well, where are we going to sleep? You know, what are we going to eat? And she didn't worry a lot about that. So she says back to me, God takes care of the lilies and the sparrows. God will take care of you. Just come.
I don't know
how you argue with that.
No, it's tough arguing with with that. Who else shaped you? I mean, Mother Teresa obviously did. Who else messed you up?
Well, I mean, the list is really too long, but I studied in college with Tony Campolo up in Philadelphia, and he's one of those folks that said that challenged my world and really challenged my political identity too. And he always said mixing the church and state's like mixing ice cream and cow manure.
Mm.
It doesn't mess up the dookie, but it sure messes up the ice cream, you know.
Yeah, the dookie. So, is that a southern thing? The dookie. I gotta write that one. How do you spell dookie?
Is that not Canadian, dookie?
Buddy, I have no idea what you're saying. Is that like a monastic term, dookie?
Poo,
oh,
manure.
All right, yes.
Third. Yeah.
Okay, no more descriptions, please.
Yeah, man. But Tony Campolo is a great friend. And another hero of mine is a guy named John Perkins, who was a veteran of the whole civil rights era. He's like 80 years old, and he's just an incredible voice of reconciliation. He actually ended up writing a book with a former Klansman, head dragon of the Ku Klux Klan, and it's called He's My Brother, God is Big Enough to Reconcile. And it just tells the story of how they were able to transcend their past and love one another. It's incredible. So he's another hero of mine.
Well, I guess one of the main reasons I've got you on the show is because Tony Campolo got up my nose about getting you on the show. And so when Tony says jump, I just say how high. That's kind of how it works. Because otherwise he ends up spitting across the desk at me when he gets, you know, passionate about stuff.
Terrible, isn't it? Terrible.
I would imagine him playing Macbeth would be an exciting thing. Just thought I'd throw that out there. Listen, you said this is a project to provoke the Christian political imagination. First of all, that sounds like an oxymoron, Christian political imagination. There's just three words that don't belong in the same sentence. But how does this especially translate here in Canada, where we don't wrap our Bible up in the flag?
Well, I know that, and that we're going to do a little Jesus for Prime Minister stop there in Toronto, but a big part of it is to challenge sort of the marriage of our Christian identity with our nationalism here in the States. But it's much bigger than that. When we track back to Jesus, we look at the political world that he grew up in and how he transcended camps and pointed towards, I mean, just no room for political rhetoric. So when they come and they try to trap him into questions like, do you pay your taxes? He tells them to go get a fish and it'll have a 4-drachma coin in its mouth. And I love that. You know, what in the world? Like, fish don't usually have coins in their mouths, you know? And it's just as if to say, you can have the coin. I made the fish. You know, Caesar can have coins with his image on them. I made human beings. They have my image on them, and Caesar has no right to that. And we look at that same creativity and go, what does it mean to live with that imagination today? Because in Jesus, we don't see a political platform of ideas, but really an invitation to join up with a movement that embodies God's good news to the poor. So the stories of that, I think, are they transcend nationality, and they're happening all over the world, and they're little stories. One of the ones that we tell is a group of Christians that began to meet each other's medical bills, and it started with a poor community of just 400 folks, and now it's 20,000 Christians that every month get a newsletter of who's in the hospital, pull their money together, and I'm actually one of those. And over the last 20 years, we've paid over $450 million in medical bills of one another. And it's those things that we go, we're not just going to point to the government and say, you've got to do what God has commissioned the church to be. And I think that's a challenge no matter where we live, and especially when we live in places like Canada where everything's perfect, you know.
Absolutely false. The odd time, Shane, I catch myself using my mouth more than my actions. And you're known as Mr. Action Guy. You're known as, you know, like the young male Mother Teresa of United States kind of deal.
Lord have mercy.
That's a scary thought, to be honest. And I wonder if you ever get stuck in that position where you wake up in a cold sweat some nights and go, you know what? I am just continuously crapping on about this stuff. I wonder if am I really living it? Or are you really living it? I mean, you just gave a great example of that whole, you know, get our money together and pay each other's medical bills. But what happens when that kind of conviction comes on you? And does it come on you?
Well, Drew, I'm actually out of time. I got a sushi dinner.
Oh, yeah.
Waiting up here.
All the best. Bye-bye now.
I mean, part of what we really believe is that we got to be able to laugh a little bit together and not take ourselves too seriously. And that's the thing I love about my community is we are really wrestling with, I mean, hard stuff. Kids that get beat up by their dads, you know, folks that are addicted to heroin. But in it all, I think we really have to be people that are able to laugh a little bit. And on our wall, we have the Emma Goldman quote, "If I can't dance, then it's not my revolution." And I love that. Because social justice people are not necessarily known by their joy.
I'm so glad you said that. Seriously. Because I would hang around with the tree huggers and the whale kissers if they had a personality.
I got to tell you one story. There was one night where I went to sleep early, and my housemates hung a life-size poster of George Bush above my bed.
Oh, that's wrong.
And I'm on the top bunk, so it's about a foot from my face. So I wake up the next morning, I'm like, "Oh, dear Lord!" You know? I woke up to him and actually left him there. So now he sleeps, you know, just a foot above me, and I can look him in the eyes and go, "Okay, it's good to know that this guy is neither the devil nor the savior."
Yeah.
And I can pray for him, and I can laugh a little bit and remember that, you know, not to take ourselves too seriously. But meanwhile, I mean, we are trying to embody with integrity the gospel and what we believe. And I think that's what young people have become so dissatisfied with you know, televangelists and cover-up bishops and politicians that do the things that politicians do, you know, and people want people that are living with integrity. And one little step of that we're trying to do on our whole tour is we're running our bus off veggie oil. I don't know if you noticed that, but we pull up to Chinese restaurants, you know, and we ask them for their oil, and we're able to run it entirely off of waste vegetable oil. So it's a pretty sweet thing. But then, you know, if we run out, we'll figure out something or run off diesel. Like, it's not like
sellout.
Everything's perfect. You
You're
know?
A sellout.
Yeah. We'll get on our knees and repent.
Yeah. I got to tell people about this book. Obviously, we're talking about Jesus for President, and that's the website as well, jesusforpresident.org. Probably one of the weirdest looking books I've ever come across.
Good, yeah.
And it's really, I don't know whether it's good for someone with ADD or not good. Because I've been all over the place. Like, this is a tough book to go from cover to cover. You just want to, I don't know, it's like a buffet. Really?
Yeah, just leave that in the toilet room, and then, you know, you can read it a little bit at a time. But part of the idea is that we wanted to animate our theology, and the same way with these presentations that we're doing in every city is it's kind of like it's like a theological circus. We've got music all through it, and art, and beauty, and we got kind of tired of dry theology books anyway.
And well, I'm glad that you did, and I think many of us have been. That's for sure. Do you really think that the church is going to lead us to peace? Because I think you're nuts.
Oh, not I think that the beautiful thing about the prophets in the scripture is they certainly don't count on any king or government leading us to peace, but it says that people will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. And then it says, "And nation will not rise up against nation." So I definitely believe that peace doesn't begin with nations or kings or presidents or prime ministers, but it begins with a people who have fallen in love with the Prince of Peace and begin to enact the world that we know is coming, where the lion and the lamb can lie down together. So,
but it certainly is hard to imagine in this day and age, at least here in North America, Christendom, that the church will lead us into peace.
Well, without a doubt, and one of the things that we lament is that what suffers so deeply when we marry our nationality and our Christianity is that what becomes at stake is not just the reputation of America, but the reputation of Christianity. And I can remember when I was over in Iraq, one of the mothers throwing her hands in the air and saying, "Your government is dropping bombs and asking God's blessing." And that's the same thing that my government's doing. What's happened to the God of love and the Prince of Peace? And I think that's a question a lot of people are asking.
Wow, there's a wake-up call. Hey, listen, can you expound on this quote? By the way, we're talking with Shane Claiborne, who's the author of Jesus for President, and some other stuff as well, but right now it's Jesus for President. JesusForPresident.org. Here's the quote. If we're crazy, it's because we refuse to be crazy in the same way that the world has gone crazy.
That's a good quote. That's not mine, by the way.
No, I know, but you like it, though, don't you?
I do like it. And part of why I like it is I think that there's a whole lot of people, especially young Christians and young non-Christians alike, that are going, the world that we've been handed by our parents is very fragile and broken, and maybe God has another dream for how we should live in this world. Especially the last 10 years, we've been sort of these voices in the wilderness, you know, that these are crazy ideas, and now suddenly there's like an entire world that's going, wow, we've got to rethink how we live. It's not right that a CEO gets paid 400 times their workers. It's not right that we're, you know, using so much of the world's resources up. And so it's part of what we're doing on this tour is going to a couple of dozen cities, and we're almost the excuse, you know, for people just to get together and plot goodness and conspire together a little holy mischief and think about how we can live contrary to the patterns of this world, as the scriptures say, not conform to the things that are so out of line with the way that God would want us to live in the world.
You know, I think the reason you stand out is not because of your attire or your hairstyle. The reason you and your cronies stand out is because you're actually doing what we should be doing. And I think the massive underground revolt with those disenfranchised with religiosity or fortress-minded Christianity is there's an internal revolt amongst all of us who are sick of the hypocrisy. I've always been sick of my own hypocrisy, and I'm certainly quite eager to point out the hypocrisy of others, because that's a gift of mine. But you're actually living this Jesus stuff.
Well, we're giving it a shot.
Oh, you're so stinking humble. Give me a break.
Hey, but I love Gandhi's quote. When they asked Gandhi if he was a Christian, he said, "Oh, I love Jesus. I just wish the Christians would take him more seriously." I think that's where in East Tennessee I started. I was going to church, but it was entertaining me with goofy games and songs. And then I started reading the Bible and going, "My gosh, does anyone really believe that Jesus meant this stuff he said?"
Yeah.
And what would the world look like if we really believed that?
All right, let's connect our people with some stories. Let's first of all talk about how redundant the Red Cross was when they set up shelters after your hood burned down.
Yeah, that was an amazing story. The fact is that our neighborhood's one of the poorest in Pennsylvania, and you know, this fire started in exactly a year ago in an abandoned factory and burnt down a dozen houses on our block. And then the Red Cross came to us, and they said, "We've set up a shelter." And then they came back like a day later, and they said, "No one ended up staying in the shelter because everybody in your neighborhood opened up their homes to each other." We're like, yes! And these are people that don't have a ton of room in their homes, you know. But it really was a time that our neighborhood shined, and again, that we're so thankful for Christians all over the world that were praying for us and sending money and donations, and we've been rebuilding this past year.
That's very cool. Should we give out the web address maybe to Church Mutual? Would that be a good idea?
Might be a good idea. An amazing thing, you know, 10 years, we've never had a claim on our insurance policy, and then we have a fire, again, started by the negligence of an abandoned city-owned factory, and then they drop us, and they said that our neighborhood's too big of a liability. Like, a liability? If we didn't have any liability, why would we need insurance, right?
Seriously. And even dealing with the city of Philadelphia, or I don't know, whatever it is, you've come across some head-turners, ways of thinking that just make your head turn to one side and go, what?
It's unbelievable. It's enough to make me want to move to Canada.
can I just caution you about that, please?
No, I'm just playing. But, the city, after the fire, the city ended up fining every family that lost their home and saying, we're giving you both a charge for the demolition and a fine for the remains of your home being a hazard to the neighborhood. Hmm. And so we, along with half a dozen neighbors, are still fighting fines of over $12,000 each. So almost $100,000 in fines that the city says we owe them. Although I'll have to say, we were going to do a press release a few days ago, 1 year after the fire, and the mayor's office called the day of and said, "Give us 30 days. We're trying to forgive the liens." And
because we realize,
makes you wonder if they're reading our email, doesn't it?
Unbelievable. Shane, why don't people like you?
people don't like me?
No, but you know what I mean. I mean, are you considered one of these emergent, Tony Campolo, Brian McLaren, kind of cronies? And I'm sure that the guy down there, MacArthur, I'm sure he doesn't like you.
Well, I honestly don't pay a ton of attention.
I know, but what do your critics say about you?
Well, the only angry letters I get are from pastors. I always say if people are angry, it should be the same people that were angry at Jesus, and if the people that are drawn to us should be the same people that were drawn to Jesus. So, but usually I try to have as many conversations with people that disagree with me as I can, because I think that one of our best witnesses to the rest of society is our ability to disagree well, and that's something that the past generation hasn't done very good. They've done a lot of work at demonizing each other, but I don't know what people say. I think one thing that people want to do is they want to box everyone together under a label like emergent. I have no idea what emergent is. To me, it seems like anybody under 40 that folks just want to write off.
Yeah.
So I'm not at all going to identify with something I don't know what it is, but I'm great friends with folks that some of whom get me in trouble and some of whom I don't agree with everything that they say, but I sure think that they're after the same gospel that I am, and so I...
Okay, I'm going to call you on that one. Who are you friends with that is totally on a different page?
Okay, I'll tell you one. Mark Driscoll out in Seattle is a friend.
Wow. I wasn't expecting that one.
I called on the phone and I said, hey, man, let's pray together because we really disagree. We disagree on a lot of things like women in leadership and, all kinds of stuff. So we actually quote him in our book when he says that there's a lot of new voices that try to make Jesus out to be a limp-wristed hippie. But the God, he says, I don't worship a God that I can beat up. So I'd say that's not great theology there, And so anyway, but Mark and I could go out to eat, together as long as he pays and have a good time. But, there's other folks too that, I think really misunderstand or equate us with things that we haven't said and things like that. So I don't have a ton of energy for that, but if they want to talk, personally, then I certainly make room because I take every critique very seriously.
Let's not paint too rosy a picture. The stuff that you do is blood and guts draining. Like, I can imagine that you're not always up on cloud nine feeling just all peachy about Jesus stuff.
Sure.
If that made any sense whatsoever. Because there's disappointment, there's rejection, you almost paint the picture like you're growing your own clothes down there, and everybody's just kind of kumbaya mode, right? But it can't be all just that peachy.
But I think that's part of the gift of community and the good news that, we're not alone as we carry these burdens, that we're bearing each other's burdens.
Right.
And in a neighborhood that's got maybe far too much of a burden than it should have, we carry that together. So when someone comes home and says, Rudolfo's dad beat him up again, then we're able to carry that together. We're able to troubleshoot that. We sort of have everybody's imagination as we think through how we can keep that from happening. So that's a part of it. And we have a really good rhythm for rest and play and, the things that bring us to life, and we have prayer every morning, things like that. So there's ways that we sustain ourselves. And we have a little saying above our door that's actually Mother Teresa's words. It says, small things with great love, or don't answer the door. And it's kind of an invitation. If you don't feel the energy to be, present with this person, then take a break.
Who does Shane Claiborne read?
Well, I'm going all fiction on our little tour here. I'm reading Kurt Vonnegut, the Slaughterhouse-Five. I'm reading, there's a few books I'm hoping to read, The Alchemist. But the folks that have been really influential on me in recent years are John Howard Yoder, Dorothy Day. Those are the ones that I sort of carry around with me. And when the fire happened, I grabbed them out,
Yeah. What's your denominational baggage?
Well, I grew up United Methodist, which is another oxymoron,
It is, too. Well said.
But I grew up, and now I end up doing these conferences for the Methodists, and I'm like, God, you got to read more John Wesley. Do you know who that is? And so that's my background, though. And course, you know, in East Tennessee, you kind of go to, I'm a mutt, you know, I went to like three or four different denominations growing up.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, listen, this man is in town next week, Monday, June 30th at 7 o'clock at the Church of the Redeemer, 162 Bloor Street West, Toronto. That's Monday, June 30th, starting at 7 o'clock, Church of the Redeemer, 162 Bloor Street West in Toronto. Shane Claiborne, author of Jesus for President. Just before we say goodbye to you, Shane, by the way, the website, jesusforpresident.org, I would really like some dirt on Tony Campolo. Is there any kind of nasty stuff you can tell me or embarrassing or, you know, one time this happened kind of deal?
Is this live?
No, this is all
okay.
Pre-recorded. No, it's live, baby.
I'll tell you one story. We had some big classes, you know, where we would have 200 people in a class or something, and Tony was talking about the looking glass self and how we end up portraying different images of who we are for different groups of people, so we end up at the end of the day not really knowing who we fully are and things like that. So this one woman raises her hand, though, and she says, not my pastor. And that was always the worst
That's
thing to
tip
begin
off
with.
Right,
you know,
there.
She's like, my pastor is totally transparent with who he is. And Tony just shoots back and says, does your pastor masturbate? And he says, I'm sure he does or has, but he's not going to run around telling everybody that. You know, and this girl's just like, bless her heart. I mean, she's in tears, you know. And, yeah, it's great.
Boy, the old Tony Campolo.
Oh, bless his heart.
He's a good guy. Good guy.
Hey, this was fun, man.
Thank you, Shane. I appreciate your heart, man.
Appreciate you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care, Drew.
Shane Claiborne on the Drew Marshall Show. It's been a while. I've had a few people suggest I get him on, and we finally did. I like his stuff. Boy, it's hard to live like him, though, huh? He's taking the whole Jesus thing pretty seriously. Maybe one of these days when I grow up, I will, too. All right, a short break. When we come back, do you think it's possible to be 100% sure that you're going to heaven? Eternal security. Folks, a little fun topic here for you, for all you fine Bereans out there. According to the Bible, it sure seems, though, that some people who think that they're going to heaven will be a little surprised to find out they missed it by that much. So doesn't this kind of suggest that none of us can be absolutely certain about our place in heaven? Like, when exactly do our names get written in the Book of Life? I'd like all the theologians out there to get the number going, 905-338-1250, 905-338-1250. And then after that, Lorna Duick joins us live in studio, Globe and Mail columnist, host of Listen Up TV. We're going to talk about the apology from Prime Minister Stephen Harper on behalf of Canadians to our First Nations people. And then we'll open up the phone lines to ask you guys, do you care about that stuff? Do we really care? We'll be right back, folks.